encourage everybody to get outdoors, get outside, find place. We talk a lot about sort of like finding your own wilderness, and it doesn't have to be off on a far mountaintop. It can just be, you know, in your backyard or a community garden or a park or something. Just like get outside and enjoy the sunshine and be in nature.
Hello and welcome back to the Outdoor Minimalist Podcast. I'm your host, Meg Carney, and I'm an outdoor and environmental writer and author of the book, Outdoor Minimalist, Wasteless Hiking, Camping, and Backpacking. The Outdoor Minimalist Podcast has the goal to give listeners actionable ways to wasteless hiking, camping, backpacking, and more during every step of their process. Your impact outdoors starts long before you hit the trail and goes beyond leave no trace ethics. You'll learn how to identify sustainable outdoor brands, how to ask hard questions regarding sustainability, and begin to shift and evolve your mindset to integrate minimalism into all of your outdoor pursuits. Happy Earth Day, everyone! I hope you all have a chance to prioritize and appreciate the world around you in a way that helps you feel more connected to the earth and yourself. For Earth Day, we released a special bonus episode on Saturday with a Knowles Leave No Trace Master Educator. So if you plan to get outside today and you haven't listened to that one, tune into our L&T bonus episode so we can leave the places we visit better than we found them. On to today's episode. In episode 130 of the Outdoor Minimalist Podcast, we introduce the idea of culinary conservation. Forewarning, if you haven't eaten or are hungry before you listen to the full episode, then you'll be starving by the end. I had the pleasure of sitting down with Justin Townsend to explore the wonders of culinary conservation and discuss his view of ethical hunting and foraging practices. Justin, a tribal member of the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma, is an avid hunter, angler, writer, and former restaurant chef whose passion for the outdoors led him to create Harvesting Nature in 2011. He travels North America with his family and is fortunate to hunt, fish, and cook, all while sharing his experiences with others through recipes, film, podcasts, and the written word. Thanks for joining me on the Outdoor Minimalist Podcast today, Justin. We've covered hunting topics a few times on the show, but your focus specifically on like culinary conservation is a new one, and I'm excited to learn more about it. But before we get to today's main course, I'd love to learn more about you. How did you get involved in outdoor recreation, and how does it fit into your life now?
First off, thanks for having me on. Excited for the conversation. I guess for me, I began pretty much as like a very young kid. Grew up in an agriculture-focused family, in a very outdoorsy family. So probably some of my youngest memories as a kid are like going out fishing with my grandfather or traipsing out through the woods or the back pastures with my friends or my cousins. So it's been pretty ingrained in me since very early on. I think I did take a bit of a break from the outdoors when I was in college. I went to school in New Orleans, and as many college kids do, became very focused on life happening in the moment and spent that there. And that's also where I started cooking professionally as well. And so kind of that engulfed my life in addition to my school studies. And then now I think it's at the point where if I'm not in the outdoors, I'm thinking about my next time being in the outdoors, whether it's hunting, fishing, or foraging, or just, you know, exercising outside or being out with my family, hiking or boating or doing things outdoors. So,
yeah. Is that upbringing, like the background you have with your family, is that what inspired you to integrate more hunting and foraging into your adult life after college?
Yeah, I would say so. So I'm also a tribal member of the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma. And, you know, Native American cuisine is very built up of wild fish and wild game. So it became very natural growing up to, you know, what we didn't grow or the small things we bought at the grocery store. We incorporated a lot of wild fish and game to like supplement our meals and stuff. So that just became later, you know, after I went to college and then sort of started thinking about my own family and my own position in life in like my mid-20s, I was like, you know what? I need to reconnect nature. I need to get back out and start to bring wild food back into our diet. And then to my wife at the time when we were just dating, she was pretty much like a full-blown vegetarian. Ironically, I was working at probably one of the best seafood restaurants in New Orleans, cooking there. And then later, after we got married, she started incorporating more seafood into her diet. But when we had kids, there was that natural conversation of, are they going to be vegetarian or are they going to have a full meat diet? So we kind of went down that path. And what we ended up with was they could have meat if it was harvested from the wild, to include fish and game, or if it came from like my family's farm, or if, you know, we knew somebody who was a rancher and we could directly point to the source of the meat. So I can say, like, my daughter is 11 and we've maintained that with her. She's never had store-bought meat, to my knowledge. I don't know if a family member snuck it in or something, but that's the way we've done it. And that's why also too, game became so important for us, because I wanted to provide them the opportunity to have a variety of protein, not just plant-based or even seafood or freshwater fish. So game became a pivotal point of their diet and something that my daughter grew to focus on as she now has started her own hunting journey, like 10 years old, 11 years old, that she's like, I want to go out and harvest my own food. And so it's really cool to see.
That's awesome. I love how you guys kind of like tackled that conversation and compromised and found a solution that was healthy and mm-hmm. suitable for your family. I think that can be kind of hard to manage sometimes, especially like because you want your kids to have some autonomy as they get older as well. So when did you start harvesting nature then? Because I know that's kind of a big focus. There's a ton of really great resources on your website and podcast. So if people want to check that out, I'll be sure to link in the show notes. But yeah, let's talk about that. What is Harvesting Nature and how did it start?
Harvesting Nature basically began as sort of an intersection of my own sort of personal journey after college. And I missed writing a lot in college. And then I missed, you know, I was still in the kitchens and I was cooking. I'm a big Anthony Bourdain fan, like huge. So that also too, kind of as an inspiration of like, what do I want to do with my world? Well, ideally like travel and eat and write and all this stuff. And I was like, well, why don't I take some of my other passions in addition to food and writing and combine them together with my outdoors side. And I think this was the time is like 2011. So the late beginning of the 2000s, you've got the emergence of Hank Shaw, Stephen Rinella, and all these great people. And I'm like, wow, they're doing cool things. I really value that. And I think there's a lot of interest personally to do that. So I kind of just started writing recipes as we would go out and hunting and fishing more and writing about it. And then 3 or 4 years later of doing this, I realized that I wanted to create kind of a community out of it. And I wasn't big on social media at the time. I think like I didn't have an Instagram. I didn't have any of that. I had Facebook because I was part of the Facebook generation, I guess, of the first few. I wanted to connect with other people, and we were living out on the West Coast in California, and California has great hunting opportunities, but the hunting culture isn't as expansive as it is in other places. And I was like, I want to connect with other people. And so I sort of shifted my mindset of like, harvesting nature is not just going to be about me. I want it to be a community area. So I started bringing in what we called field staff writers, and they would just contribute recipes or stories or how to. And so we really grew that from, I think, 2015 to about 2019. And then in 2019, we started to formalize thing a lot more and still focusing on wild food being the main aspect of it. But we're like, let's do a podcast. Like I heard my first podcast on a hunting trip. My buddy's like, hey, look at this. Like, listen to this while we're driving this like 8-hour trip. And I'm like, cool. And I got back home and I was like, you know what? I could do that. I could get on a show and talk about something for an hour or 40 minutes or whatever. And that's what we did. So we launched the Wild Fishing Game podcast. Came just before that, I put out my first cookbook, very cleverly named Eat Wild Game. And it was just, you know, a culmination of some recipes. And so that was a big milestone for me. And then we just continue to build on it to where now it's something that's morphed into this expansive group of people sharing recipes and interacting and hunting together. And we've done since then the podcast, we've done cable TV show segments, we've done a magazine we ran for a while. And then even we're working on more cookbooks right now. That's actually what I've been doing all day is trying to get that out the door. It's cool because I've met and conversed and talked with so many other like hunters and anglers as a result of it. I got more involved in conservation as a result of it and just started like broadening my aperture in the outdoors to where, like I told you earlier, like I'm either in the outdoors or I'm thinking about being in the outdoors. And I feel like as we've grown the staff that supports Harvest in Nature, it's very much like-minded. We're all like, we see the benefit of wild food and we just want to keep getting people more comfortable with it so that they can have their own journey and their own place in that space.
Yeah, I love that. It's a very organic journey, pursuing your interests, and it kind of just like snowballed and grew. And it's cool to see what it is today. And I'm glad that you could come on the podcast and share about it. I do want to touch a little bit on like the conservation pieces that you guys focus on, as well as the ethics. So anyone that listens to the podcast, this podcast, knows that I am vegan. And so obviously, vegans and hunters don't always align and have the same viewpoints. And so I love to hear from people in the sportsman space about how they define ethical hunting and how it differs, like your viewpoint would differ from other types of hunting.
I think for me, ethical hunting comes from a space of like, we talk about like culinary conservation, we're going to talk about it. And so if you think about conservation as a whole, like in North America, we follow what's called the North American model. And that's kind of the guidance of basically biology-based management of animals. I think hunting very much follows that line. It's part of the practice. It's part of the way all the states have adopted to do it. And I think first off, an ethical hunter follows the guidelines and follows the rules and the seasons and the limits and all those things, and goes beyond that by making choices that are in line with their own morality, but also to help towards conservation. When we think about going out and hunting specific species, I tend to love to hunt invasive species. We have this wild pig camp where we teach people to shoot, hunt, butcher, process wild pigs. We chose that because they're such an invasive problem. We want to popularize the thought of doing that. So that's like, to me, one ethical part that I really hold on to is like, we've got these species that are invasive to our natural environment. Like, let's focus on those as well, or first or primary. And then also too, you know, going out and not hunting an animal because I want to see this big, beautiful rack or antlers or anything like that. I will more than likely take a antlerless animal over, you know, an antlered animal anytime. And I think that just to me follows my own values of I'm out there for the meat. Now, will I harvest one of those animals? Certainly, if the opportunity presents itself and I have everything, you know, in line to do so. But I think too, ethically as hunters, we have this responsibility to sharpen our skills, to learn how to hunt with the bow, the rifle, whatever method we're using, and be direct and deliberate and make good choices when it comes to shot placement, to quickly kill the animal, to dispatch it just in a manner that doesn't induce suffering. And I think that goes down to just like our human core of not wanting to see suffering. But I think it's such an interesting thing when you talk about hunting in that way, because that's what it is. And it you can't really sugarcoat it. It's a transfer of life and nutrients from one to the other. And it's very interesting to have those conversations. So to me, ethical hunting is following the overall guidelines, but also making personal deliberate choices to get out and hunt for food, but also do so in a way that you know you're benefiting, you know, yourself, the population of animals, but also you're not causing undue stress and harm.
Anytime I feel like I ask people about that, a lot of times it kind of comes down to like intentionality, like how intentional are you being about how you're interacting with nature? So that's really cool. I'm glad that you're kind of communicating that through the Harvesting Nature message as well. And conservation. Conservation always comes up in the hunting space because sportsmen contribute a lot to conservation, at least in the United States. So do you mind kind of overviewing how you guys approach conservation and also what you mean when you say culinary conservation?
We approach conservation in the aspect of we want to protect wild places. We want to protect public land access. We want to protect, you know, the thriving population of animal species as well. So that's really focusing on what I mentioned before, that sort of like biology-based conservation of like following the guidelines that are set forth by the state, but also understanding that shooting more male deer over female deer, you know, from those aspects. There's all kinds of little nuances that we've learned over time. We as hunters have learned over time to sort of like better ourselves in this space, I guess, because a lot of people will default to the fact that, oh, I'm a hunter because I buy my duck stamp and duck stamps go to fund conservation efforts, or I buy my gun and there's a tax imposed on there and that goes to the Fish and Game Agency. I think it's really important to think beyond that. Getting out and identifying a conservation organization, whether it be, you know, Ducks Unlimited, Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, the Mule Deer Foundation, like any of these organizations, like just find one and go spend time and learn and participate in efforts, reforestation, rehabilitation, getting out and just engaging yourself in that to give back to the land that you use. It helps build better populations for animals, which, you know, I think we have a very important thing as hunters and anglers to do, because that continuity of those healthy populations is where we're getting our protein. And that's kind of that culinary conservation aspect that you start to see. I'm making deliberate choices to participate in conservation because I see the end result being, one, there's future land use for future generations. Two, they get to enjoy the same activities that I do. Three, there's an availability of food there that if it's not watched and protected, that won't be. The last bit that rounds off that like culinary conservation is what I mentioned earlier of like following practices that make sense. Like if I'm going to go out and say I'm hunting in an area that's very overpopulated with deer, maybe I figure out, should I shoot, you know, a buck or a doe, based on whatever's recommendation by the biologist, and to, you know, not always the biggest is the best.
Yes, not always the biggest is the best. But once again, back to intentionality, like kind of like figuring out like, why are you doing this? What's your motivation? And like kind of aligning with your values. Mm-hmm. Adventuring plans on your calendar? Remember to grab your Lava Linens travel towel on your way out the door. Founded by a mother-daughter team, Lava Linens crafts durable, luxurious travel towels as a more sustainable and better performing alternative to microfiber and cotton towels. Powered by flax, hemp, and Tencel, they're designed to be by your side for years to come. Use the code OUTDOORMINIMALIST for 15% off your next order. So I guess as people are approaching this, and if they are current sportsmen, hunting, fishing, that's already a part of their life, how can they align better with conservation? And then also, how can people get more involved in eating local foods? So that could be from learning how to hunt, maybe learning how to fish, or even learning how to forage.
For those that haven't or aren't involved in conservation, you know, beyond just purchasing license and things like that, is like find that conservation organization out there. One of the great things too is like connecting with state agencies. So state fish and game agencies, wildlife management agencies, parks and rec, whatever, they go by different names wherever you're at, but connecting with them and seeing what volunteer opportunities there are. So much of this space is people utilize the outdoors for their personal benefit. And I think rounding that out with some like, I'm going to give some of my personal time back to the outdoors for the benefit of the outdoors is probably the best way to get involved in conservation. Just know that when you talk to people who don't hunt, who don't fish, who don't like the outdoors, that you're representing a group of people and you're representing a lifestyle. And I think understand that you are being watched and people are watching you, and do so in a positive manner, because even what you say and what you do, if you throw a Butterfinger wrapper on the ground when you're out on a hike and somebody sees you, they're gonna be like, that guy litters. We don't want to be known like, oh, this trail, that's where all the people go that go litter. They just go throw their trash on the ground. Be intentional, like you mentioned. You know, understand that you're representing a group at large, and I think be honorable about it. And for people that want to get into hunting and fishing, for hunting, the best avenue is to take a look at hunter's education. That's usually a baseline for purchasing any kind of licensing to hunt with. It's also a safety baseline. It's all these things, but you can start to connect. And back, 20, 30 years ago when I started hunting, there weren't programs for people new to hunting as there are now, like Colorado Parks and Wildlife, like where I live, they have so many programs to help people who want to get into hunting. If you're a first-time hunter, we've got a mentorship program. We've got an opportunity for you to come out and learn how to hunt pheasant. We'll spend a day with you teaching you how to do it, and then you go on out to someone's field or pasture where they've allowed the state to use for hunting. And then we too, at Harvested Nature, we've got courses that we do a couple times a year. We're looking to expand it quarterly, but we focus on overpopulated invasive species, but we want to teach people how to hunt or fish, butcher, process, and cook. And we wrap that all into like some courses. We keep a low price point. It's very approachable. And it's meant to build a mentorship base, to build a group of people that want to do it. But also our goal is for you to leave one of those camps and have the skills and be comfortable to go out and do it on your own. That's kind of, I think, the big thing is also finding a network of people, which is sometimes hard if you're an older person getting into something new, even if it's a sport or something.
Do you think that it's a similar approach for something like foraging? Because someone like me, I probably wouldn't be taking a hunting class, but sure, I would be interested in learning about foraging in my local area.
Foraging is awesome. A lot of people just think foraging for mushrooms is like kind of the first thing. And I'm still very much a novice at foraging mushrooms. So I tend to not as much or be overly cautious. But I think finding someone in your community or going to a course or connecting with people online, like I'm in a Colorado mycological group where people will talk about different mushrooms they've harvested. They'll post pictures. They'll talk about the different elevations the morel mushrooms are growing at. There's several really good experts on wild food out there that, you know, just kind of have open forums to come talk and chat with them. And then there's many, many classes. So I would say if you want to get into foraging, even beyond mushrooms, so we're talking about plants, berries, whatever, get a book, go practice, walk around, learn things. Don't eat anything yet. Take a course, learn. I always go with a three-step verification before I eat anything. One, I want to know I'm comfortable, like, all right, that's a morel mushroom. Two, I'll probably post or share a picture on groups and share with friends. I'll reference it in a book, and then I'll like be 99% sure before I eat that. But there are other things too, like dandelions in your yard, right? Like the flowers, if you're not using like pesticides or fertilizers on your yard, like go pick the dandelions, make dandelion jam. Or I just saw it was a dandelion bud capers, which sounds really phenomenal and yummy. Just things like that. And it's funny because once you start foraging and start learning what things are, you'll go out and you'll be like, oh my gosh, there's that. And then you'll just see it everywhere. Whereas before, you'll just walk through kind of oblivious to it. So it's super cool. I encourage like everybody get into foraging. It's great. I've taught my kids to do it, and we'll be out somewhere and, you know, at a park or whatever, and they'll come running back and have like a handful of stuff. And they're like, what's this? What's this? And we'll just have to kind of like figure out what it is through process of deduction, which is awesome.
That's awesome. Yeah, I love that observation piece. And dandelions, I love dandelion greens. I eat them a lot. So yeah, I haven't done that much with like the flowers though. I don't super love the taste. Like I've tried the dandelion wine and jams and stuff, and I'm not sure it's for me.
That's fine. Whatever makes you happy. I think, man, there's like dandelion. You can take the root and roast it, make coffee with it. You can do stuff with the greens. I do like the jam. I save it all for winter. Like today, it's probably snowed 8 inches or so outside. So we'll probably crack open some dandelion jam. It's like a little taste of sunshine.
Since we're talking about food and you have a culinary background, have written cookbooks, do you have like a specific favorite recipe? It doesn't have to be a favorite because I'm sure there's a lot, like one that you go back to often.
I'm like a big fan of braised meats. So like on most wild game, there's the shanks, which is kind of like the forearm portion or the back portion of it. So it'd be the calf or the forearm on the animal. It's like notoriously tough because there's a lot of connective tissue in there. But whenever you cook it in like a braise and you slow cook it for like hours, you can put starch in there, like potatoes and vegetables and stuff like that. And you just let it cook until everything kind of melts and you're just left with this really tender, beautiful tasting meat. I think it tastes better than most of the like popular cuts that people get, like the loin or, you know, steaks or things like that. I think the shank is phenomenal. It's my favorite cut. But anything done with that, like you can add wine to it, you can add stock to it, you can add all this this. You can take the liquid off once it's cooked and make a pan sauce and drizzle over the top of it. You can serve it over mashed potatoes or rice, or make it really spicy and colorful, like a Szechuan dish or like a Moroccan tagine. There's so much you can do with it. It's so fun to work with, but that's probably one of my go-tos, because also I can just like prepare it, put it in the oven and let it cook. And then I'm a huge multitasker, so I could do like 50 other things while I'm waiting and then just know it's going to come out really, really good.
Yeah, that sounds really good. I don't even eat meat, and that made me hungry. And if listeners want to learn more about you and Harvesting Nature, where's the best place to find you?
So you can head over to harvestingnature.com. It's where like the bulk of our content is. You can visit us on Instagram. It's just at Harvesting Nature. And then all of our audio via podcast is the Wild Fish and Game Podcast or Wild Fish and Game Podcast. One of the two. You'll find it. And you'll see a picture of me holding up like two big pieces of meat on the cover. But that's the best place. And we're pretty responsive too, to chats and emails. So
I'll be sure to include all the links to that in the show notes so people can find it easily. But with that, Justin, thank you so much for taking the time to share your story with us.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening. And if you like what you hear, let me know. Leave a review and be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. You can find us on Instagram at outdoor.minimalist.book, on YouTube, or subscribe to our weekly newsletter at theoutdoorminimalist.com. For even more updates, other educational resources, and to help build an outdoor community with the shared goal to create a better outdoor space as we recreate.